The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to today's podcast, sponsored by Hillsdale College. All things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. I encourage you to take advantage of the many free online courses there. And, of course, to listen to the Hillsdale Dialogues, all of them at hughforhillsdale.com, or just Google Apple, iTunes, and Hillsdale. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway today. I hope you had a great weekend. It's a wonderful Monday. Over the weekend, the House of Representatives passed a $95.3 billion package of bills. And that's usually just the top line is what you get over and over again from people. I wanted to dig into the details of each of the four bills. So I asked Rear Admiral Mark Montgomery, retired from the United States Navy, Vice President of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, to join me. Good morning, Admiral. Thank you for coming back so soon.
Hey, thank you for having me, Hugh. Really excited to be here today and discuss a really important topic.
Well, let's begin with the portion of the bill that went to Israel. It's called the Israel Security Supplemental Appropriations Act, $26.38 billion. It starts with $4 billion to replenish Iron Dome and David Sling. You want to explain what that means?
Sure, thanks. So Iron Dome and David Sling are Israeli-made, although the Iron Dome is made with with assistance from U.S. Factories in Arizona and with U.S. Investment in the technology. So Iron Dome and David Sling are two of the three key portions of Israeli integrated missile defense. So Iron Dome is particularly good against rockets and mortars. So it was used very heavily October 7th and in the immediate days thereafter with attacks from Hamas. And it would also be very critical to any engagement with Hezbollah from the north, Hezbollah having somewhere between 150 and 170,000 rockets, mortars, and missiles. So that's Iron Dome. David Sling is their counter-cruise missile. It's, the Israelis had Patriots, and they decided to go down their own path. So it's a Patriot-like cruise missile defense system. It's used against kind of high-end cruise missile threats, mostly from Hezbollah or Iran itself. So those two systems are key to Israel's self-defense against attacks from their neighbors by rockets, mortars, and cruise missiles.
Are they buying with that $4 billion basically reload capacity? They're not buying new systems, are they? Or perhaps they're doing both. I'm not quite sure.
So that's a great question. It's both reload capacity and, in the case of Iron Dome, another factory. And there's been negotiations over a factory in, I believe, Arkansas would be the goal there, so that there'll be an investment there and an ability to kind of increase the procurement level of Iron Dome year over year. So that'll take a couple of years to come into effect. But in the meantime, there's increased money for the capacity at the current plant, and there's increased money for capacity at the David Sling plant.
There is also $1.2 billion in the bill for the, quote, Iron Beam, close quote, defense system. What is Iron Beam?
So Iron Beam is a directed energy system. Again, Israeli, be done by an Israeli company, but a lot of work done in the United States. We're developing our own. You know, we have one for destroyers called Helios, another one that's on, the Army has, I think, on Stryker vehicles. But the U.S. Army, U.S. Navy are kind of pushing down a directed energy. I think the reason behind this is cost per shot. You know, we're having to deal with drones and cheap rockets that, you know, can cost somewhere between, you know, $20,000 and $40,000 a piece. And we're shooting them down right now with effectors, that is missiles that cost anywhere. The Iron Dome's the cheap end, around $30,000 or $40,000. But a lot of the other systems we've been using and the Israelis have been using cost $1 million around or even more. So the idea is to shift to directed energy. And Iron Beam, this is a significant investment in Iron Beam. I think a low-power Iron Beam is imminent. This would really be about getting to a higher power directed energy weapon for Iron Beam so that they can decrease the cost per shot when they're dealing with threats from Hamas and Hezbollah and kind of local, you know, IRGC proxy groups in Syria. You know, Iron Beam's going to be a cost effective
one. We've got a lot of Steelers fans listening and even some Ravens fans. They have no idea what directed energy means. What's it look like? Is it like Cyclops and the X-Men with the visor? What is it?
You know, I think that's about right. So it's a beam of energy that's formed by a power unit and it is focused very specifically. And so it has to be a very, you know, a high, this laser has to be very focused and of a sufficient power and then agile so that it can track, you know, cruise missiles, rockets and mortars, you know, cruise missiles can maneuver, rockets and mortars can become unstable and, you know, oscillate as they come in. And they're coming in sometimes at Mach speeds, up to 1,000 or 2,000 miles an hour. So this beam has to be able to track very carefully. So it has to have very good fire control to help place the beam. And the beam has to be very specifically applied to a spot on an incoming rocket or missile for seconds at a time. And in order to cause the damage to the microelectronics inside the inbound missile, or to destroy the coating of the frame of the missile.
Does it burn a hole in it? Is that what it does? Burn a hole in it?
I mean, metaphorically, yes. I mean, and the question of, you know, how it burns the hole, what it does to the microelectronics can be slightly different between systems and depending on power. But basically, it does that. And so what happens is, as long as you give it juice, it's like your electric car, I guess, you know. Now, the recharge has got to be a lot faster, but you can constantly be engaging with an iron beam battery, you know, shot after shot after shot after shot, at essentially, you know, dollars on the shot versus tens of thousands of dollars on the shot.
Does the United States have this technology yet, Admiral?
We do. We're at about this, you know, we're probably a little ahead of Iron Beam with our Navy and Army systems that we're just starting to field. But we need to get to a higher power as well. So we're also, you'll find similar kind of money, maybe not clumped together in one $1.2 billion thing like this, but similar amounts of money in the fiscal year 2024 and 2025 budgets to push directed energy. We're almost all the advanced militaries were slow to adopt this. We kind of like to see two things go smash. And, you know, we kind of understand that that's a destruction. So I think we've been a little slow to get to this, but we're running to it now because the cost per shot is really hard, especially against these Iranian Shahid drones that cost maybe $30,000 a piece.
The next line in what the speaker put out is fairly ambiguous. $3.5 billion for procurement of advanced weapon system defense articles and defense services through the Foreign Military Financing Program. I don't know what that means. Do you?
Yeah, I do. And so we already have a deal with the Israelis. We give the Israelis about $3.9 billion a year, every year, in like a 10-year deal in Foreign Military Financing, or FMF. So this is what they do with that is they buy U.S. weapon systems like joint directed munition, you know, airdropped munitions, 155 millimeter artillery, weapons for their systems. And so what we're telling them, and it's spent in the United States. So what we're saying is here's another $3.5 billion, kind of a plus up to account for what you expended in this combat operation in Gaza and to help you prepare better should Hezbollah engage you or should the Iranians do an all-front war attack on you of some sort. So it allows Israel to replenish its American-supplied munitions and systems, about $3.5 billion worth.
All right, then we've got $2.4 billion for current U.S. military operations in response to recent attacks. I assume that's for the Houthi missile defense. Do you think that's what that is?
That's exactly it. It's for what the services have spent to be there. So it's for the ships, the aircraft carrier strike groups and the ships operations, the squadron operations, you know, those two F-15 squadrons did a pretty good job, last Saturday night, knocking down, 75 to 80 drones launched from Iran towards Israel. So the operations of those, and then very specifically, it'll help get at the munitions problem. The Secretary of the Navy, Carlos Del Toro, last week revealed, a big number. He said, we've spent almost $1 billion worth of naval munitions in the Red Sea. I think you might include the Eastern Mediterranean in that, the SM-3 missiles that were fired to defend Israel against ballistic missiles. So all of that collectively is $2.4 billion. My guess is because we had, when we put this money, the number together, we hadn't done the defense of Israel from that 300 drone and cruise and ballistic missile attack. That $2.4 billion is probably on the low end of what the military would want. But this reimburses them because otherwise they have to pay for all these kind of operations and munitions out of hide and cut some other money.
Okay, I'm coming right back with Admiral Montgomery. There's a lot more in this bill. The Ukraine provisions, the Indo-Pacific security position, the 21st Century Peace Through Strength Act. We're going to go through it line by line of what the speaker put out because it's just not enough to know $95.3 billion. That's the total, but what did it buy? I'll continue my conversation with the Admiral right after this. I'm back with Admiral Mark Montgomery. Admiral, before I move on, there's also $9 billion in the Israeli security supplemental for, quote, humanitarian aid. Some of that's going to go to Gaza, but do you have any idea where that goes and who divvies it out? That's a lot of money under a very big umbrella.
So our traditional, it is a lot of money. And I'm uncomfortable when they say this is part of the, support to Israel. I mean, I get you had to bin it somewhere. I mean, I want to say the things we talked about, I think there's one or two other small ones, like $1 billion to improve U.S. production for the missile systems that we tend to send Israel. That's what I consider the Israel money. And then you're absolutely right. There's $9 billion in here for worldwide humanitarian usage. The only group, it'll be distributed initially by U.S. Agency for International Development. That's who does our kind of assistance money. But let me tell you the one international agency that will not be distributing this, and that's UNRWA, the United Nations Relief Agency in Palestine, because they're banned in this legislation from being the distributor of this. So I don't know exactly who at the non-governmental organization level will deliver it, but I know who won't. And I think that was a good move.
In fact, there is a specific prohibition against UNRWA getting anything. Let me turn, if we can now, and I'll continue this in the next segment as well, to the Indo-Pacific Security Supplemental. This is only $8 billion total. So the humanitarian aid is $9 billion, and our Indo-Pacific Security Supplemental is $8.12 billion. Are you underwhelmed by that number? Is it better than nothing, or is it what we need?
It is better than nothing and starting to approach what we need. Now, that's a weird thing to say. You're right. Well, that's a smaller number. Well, here's how deterrence against these authoritarian regime works. If I were to deter you in peacetime, it's going to cost me X to get my forces to show you my commitment, show you my capabilities and capacity. If I wait till combat starts, the number is going to be 3 or 4X. And we're learning that in Ukraine. We're learning that in Israel. So, look, this is the first time we've kind of said out loud as a Congress and then and when the president signs it as an executive branch, that we actually need to do this kind of unique funding to get ourselves ready to deal with China. So I'm not underwhelmed. If you gave another $2 or $4 billion could be wisely spent? Yes. But having said that, I think this was a wise investment of $8 billion. And it would have only happened with the Ukraine and Israel initiatives tied to it.
Now, there's $3.3 billion in this, and we might have to go in the next segment, $3.3 billion in the Indo-Pacific supplemental to develop submarine infrastructure. This will make our friend Captain Hendricks very happy, including investments in dry dock construction. Where are we going to build dry dock construction?
So I think it's too early to say exactly where. I will say this. This is about both fixing our ability to maintain our current submarines, which has absolutely fallen off the face of the earth over the last decade, and our ability to build new submarines. So we can build one Columbia-class ballistic missile submarine a year and closer to three Virginia-class. I mean, right now, you and I pay to build two Virginia-class submarines a year, but we only get delivered to us about 1.3. So there's a big backlog developing because of secondary and tertiary supply chains. So this $3.3 billion goes to both building and maintaining. And as you and I have spoken before, you know, in our war planning, we say unclassified. We need about 69 submarines to make it work. Today, we have 52. We're heading in the wrong direction because of the retirement of the Reagan-era build-up submarines. So we could get down as low as 48, 47, 46. But this will help bend that curve back over time.
Pause for a second. We'll come right back. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway in the ReliefFactor.com studio. During the break, Admiral Montgomery and I were discussing, and we'll put it into the podcast, what exactly is going to be purchased in the Indo-Pacific Security Supplemental. $3.3 billion to build submarines, some of it here, maybe some of it in Australia. Admiral, you think they're going to build a dry dock in Australia?
I think over time, you know, the Australians will eventually build their own submarine capacity. Now, remember, that part of what's called AUKUS, Australia-US-UK agreement, is Australia investing in our submarine industrial base. So this is going to leverage our own kind of suboptimal investments in our submarine base. It is improving in the last 2 years' budgets. Australian investment in our industrial base in this, and I'd still say we're playing catch-up. So this is what happens when you stop thinking about a weapon system in 1990 and start thinking about it again in 2014 or 15.
All right, let's move over to the Ukraine security supplemental. It includes $60.8 billion, of which 48.3% will fund the U.S. defense industrial base. First of all, it converts everything into a loan. I don't know what that means. It requires the administration to provide Congress within 45 days a strategy for prioritizing specific and achievable objectives. Are you optimistic about that document, Admiral?
I am. It's a really complex document to read. But what I'll say is you're absolutely right. Of the $60.8 billion, 48.3 are specifically defense industrial based things. It's basically about buying something in America. The question is how, or paying for American troops and soldiers. The question is the vehicle through which it does it. So this money isn't going to be corrupted or extorted or lost in Ukraine. It is literally going back into our system. So $23.2 billion is for replenishing U.S. Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps stores as we draw them down to pass them to Ukraine. That's what we've been doing traditionally. It's using something called presidential drawdown authority. It also is investing in our munitions. And I should have mentioned in the Taiwan one and in the Israel one, there's similar little plugs that actually just go to say, look, we build 10,000 rounds a month of 155 millimeter artillery. We'll pay to have better factory production to get that number up to 15 or 20. So that's literally investing in factories in the United States. And it does this for 155, which is a artillery round, the PAC-3 cruise missile, the guided missile launcher round, the Gimlers that we fire, you know, that Ukraine's been firing, the Javelins, we've all heard of that anti-tank weapon, the standard missiles that we're firing in the Red Sea, the rolling airframe missiles we're firing in the Red Sea, all that kind of stuff. We're improving our ability to produce that. And we're providing another group of money to do presidential drawdown authority to push that stuff to Ukraine. I expect there'll be, the minute when the president signs this bill, within an hour or two, Air Mobility Command, our C-17 command, will be flying out of, you know, South Carolina and Missouri, you know, to Europe, to Germany and Poland to deliver weapons. There's also $13.8 billion for us to help Ukraine pick things to buy directly to U.S. factory. So instead of the U.S. Army buying it to replace their stuff, here's another $13.8 billion for the Ukrainians to buy it. And then again, this is not a jobs bill, but the jobs supported by this bill are in, 50 U.S. states.
I saw a map, actually, of every facility that is getting a purchase order out of this bill. And it's not 50 states, but it's awfully close. I didn't realize what they made in Maine and Ohio and California. I went to look at the states where I spend time. It's everywhere. Don't go anywhere, Admiral. I've got to do a program note here and earn a little revenue. We got to come back and talk about the accountability provision that's in the Ukraine bill as well during the break. And then we've got to get to the big part of the bill, which is, in my view, the TikTok provisions and the supplementals. We've done Israel. We've done Taiwan. We're talking about Ukraine. We got one more thing. Don't go anywhere. Admiral Mark Montgomery coming back during the break, and one more segment after the break as we get into the nitty-gritty of what the House did. Stay tuned. I'm back with Admiral Mark Montgomery. We have two more segments to go. This segment, Admiral, I want to talk about the $26 million for oversight and accountability for aid to Ukraine. Now, that's nothing compared to $95 billion that we spent overall. What's this $26 million for accountability supposed to do?
So the $26 million allows us, it's to ensure that we're properly inspecting and assessing the processes for the distribution of the funds, you know, that we're talking about. I mean, $95 billion is a big chunk of change of our taxpayer money. Again, I don't think it'll be going through. It'll do some due diligence on U.S. factories and things like that. But, you know, we already do assessments, inspections of our own, you know, several hundred billion dollars a year worth of procurement in those same factories, like you said, in almost 50 states, but really concentrated Texas, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia. This is really about looking downrange. Are our operations that we're conducting in Germany and Poland, you know, where we've had to hire, introduce extra U.S. service members and contractors to move this equipment, to train the Ukrainian forces that we bring out of Ukraine to train. And then, of course, the actual money spent inside Ukraine. Now, remember, part of that $60 billion Ukraine package was about $9 billion worth of direct financial support to the Ukrainian government. And this is that percentage that wasn't security money and direct support to Eastern Europeans. And this is the money that's a loan. But previously, it's been grants. So we're going through and making sure, is that money being properly used to keep the government, you know, to keep the Ukrainian system functioning so it can use the weapons we have, you know, with the training they do inside their country, things like that. So that we need inspectors to do that. It's a little expensive because you're not, you know, it's a mix, a small number of U.S. people through our Office of Defense Cooperation in Kiev, and then contractors we hire to do these inspections. So my take is that's a pretty small, that's like an insurance payment on your car to make sure, you know, that the money you're spending on this overall package is getting spent well. I mean, I can promise you, President Zelensky does not have a yacht in Florida. He doesn't have a mansion there. That is not where the problem happens. I think at a very granular level with the distribution of some of this money, there could be, you know, we've seen this in U.S. aid money before. There could be misuse. This is Office of the Inspector General and other tools, money to look for that.
So, Admiral, do you think we're going to switch now in the next segment to the total spent on TikTok and things like that? Do you think we've done our job on Ukraine? Do you think we've actually given them enough to persevere for another year in the war?
So I am impressed with this, right? This is the only way to deter authoritarians, right? Is to put either your blood or your treasure up when they bully another country like this. So and this is an integrated. You know, President Bush had his axis of evil comments. I think he was 20 years ahead of proof. This is an axis of authoritarianism between China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea. North Korea is cranking artillery rounds over almost 3 million to Russia. Iran is providing Russia with Shahed drones and ballistic missile parts. And China is backstopping the Russian economy against the sanctions we've been applying and the oil, ban on oil and natural gas purchases. So they're working like an alliance. We democracies needed to work like an alliance. And that's what this is. And it also puts the spotlight back on the Europeans. You need to be doing your job. They've been passing some agreements inside their own multilateral and, you know, national assemblies to provide money as well. So I think combined, this gets at it. And if I can mention one other thing, it does direct the president to deliver long-range attackums, which is a long, you know, it's a 400-kilometer-ish, you know, range missile that can strike deep into Crimea, hit the Kerch Bridge, you know, do real damage, allow the Ukrainians to do real artillery damage to Russian logistics and command and control sites in occupied Crimea. So there's a lot of really good stuff here, Hugh, and so I do like it.
All right, when we come back from break, the last segment that we're going to do is on the 21st Century Peace Through Strength Act. Admiral Montgomery spent the year since he left the United States Navy on active duty advising the Congress on a number of things. I think a lot of it came together in this last portion of the bill, and we'll talk about it that right after the break. Stay with us on The Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Admiral Mark Montgomery, Rear Admiral Mark Montgomery, retired United States Navy, joining me. He is the Vice President of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Follow it at FDD on X. Follow the Admiral at Mark C. Montgomery on X. Admiral, the catch-all, the 21st Century Peace Through Strength Act, also passed on Saturday. We've talked about funding for Israel, funding for Taiwan and our Indo-Pacific, funding for Ukraine. Now let's talk about this catch-all act, and let's start with China. This will force the sale of TikTok or its closure within 1 year. Why is that important? And you might want to tell people what you did on the Cyber Solarium.
So thank you. Yeah, so this is Speaker Johnson's, you know, addition to the Senate. Generally, what we discussed earlier was generally what the Senate sent over, except with that loan correction that you mentioned for grants for some of that money. This is the big ad, and it's a really brilliant move by him and his team. Because it goes right at three of these authoritarians, Iran, Russia, and China. China, it very specifically goes right after the requirement to divest or sell TikTok from foreign ownership by a country of concern, China, to another ownership group from a friendly country or the United States, and probably the United States. Look, this was passed earlier to some fanfare about less than a month ago. Mike Gallagher's committee pushed it through. And as you mentioned, now former Representative Gallagher was chairman of the China Select Committee. He'd previously been chairman of the Cyberspace Solarium Commission, and he was chairman of the Cyber Committee of the House Armed Services Committee. So very focused on China and cyber. We worked with him over years to try to identify, foreign influence operations like TikTok and deal with them. And that's what's going on here. TikTok, the algorithm that drives what your children or grandchildren see on TikTok is driven by ByteDance, a Chinese company completely in the control of the Chinese Communist Party. So what came up on a TikTok when you enter, when you tried to access things was very much an influence operation from the Chinese Communist Party. We saw it if you looked up things like support for Israel, or support for Uyghurs, or a minority being suffering a genocide in China, things like that were all 8-to-1 to 10-to-1 to 20-to-1 more likely, to be seen in TikTok than in Instagram in a way that the Chinese Communist Party could affect our children. So what happened was that bill was going to languish a little bit in the Senate while Senator Maria Cantwell kind of dithered with it. She wanted a few things. One of them was an extension on the time to sell or divest before it's outright banned. And that's from 180 days to potentially 1 year. I think that's not the worst amendment you could have in it. So she got that one concession, but now it gets passed on Tuesday by the Senate, period.
It's a big deal. From my perspective, it's a big deal. We got it done finally. Finally got it done.
Yeah.
What about the provisions that implement sanctions on Iranian and Chinese technology transfers benefiting UAV warfare in Ukraine? How do we impose those? Who does that? Is that Sisyphus?
Well, so there's specific things in there. You're right. It's about Iranian oil and people who support them with it. Companies from international companies that support the illegal sale of Iranian oil. Missiles and drones, people who facilitate them getting missiles and drones, and very specifically UAV technology, and anyone who supports Hamas and Palestine Islamic Jihad, and some other things, and some senior officials in Iran. But you're absolutely right. The issue, these sanctions have existed before to limit it, to some effect, and then to limited effect. That limited effect is when our allies and partners don't join us in this. So the Biden administration's responsibility here is to go out and pressure our allies and partners to follow suit, to properly enforce existing sanctions and to consider new sanctions against Iran for its authoritarian behavior and its inappropriate behavior throughout the Middle East, but very specifically towards Israel.
No, I just want to read for people the sanctions provisions from the Iran summary. Sanction ports, vessels, and refineries dealing in Iranian oil. Sanction anyone involved in buying, selling, or manufacturing Iranian missiles or drones. Force the executive branch to fully implement sanctions on high-ranking Iranian officials. Impose sanctions on anyone supporting Hamas, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, other Palestinian terror groups. Stop Iran from accessing U.S. technology to manufacture missiles and drones. Update sanctions for using civilians as human shields. And sanction those producing the drug Captagon, which is manufactured and sold by the Assad regime. That was Brad Thor's most recent thriller, I believe. Does that all add up to anything in your eyes, Admiral? Do sanctions actually work?
Look, sanctions can deprive Iran of billions of dollars. You know, as we saw recently, you can then mistakenly return those dollars, which is what the Biden administration did just prior, you know, to and even after October 7th. So, you know, from my perspective, sanctions can work. They can work well if you get significant allies and partners. I mean, we need to talk with India about this. You know, we need to make sure they're fully engaged on making on implementing this. They're a fellow democracy. They need to worry about an autocracy, China, on their border. They need to be a little more sensitive to U.S. demand signals on this. So Europe, India, we're not going to get China or Russia to help with Iranian sanctions. We know that. But we need to, get our allies and partners on this. And I don't have a lot of confidence in the Biden administration's work on making oil more expensive between now and November, which is what pushing hard on the Iranian oil sanctions, that first one you listed, would do. I mean, there's reports they've even told the Ukrainians to take it easy on Russian oil distribution and refinery networks, and, you know, the attacks that the Ukrainians have been doing on them. So I expect some hard work on the senior official stuff, on the missiles and drone stuff, on the Captagon drug out of Syria, but I don't expect much on the oil.
So let's put a bow on it, Admiral. When you look at the whole package, the $95 billion, are you very excited, or not excited at all about what the House did?
I'm very excited. I mean, this is the first, you know, action by us in the last 6-9 months that says we're committed to the deterrence of authoritarian regimes. On a reasonably bipartisan basis, each of these bills passed with over 300 votes, you know, to in the House. They'll pass in the Senate. I think they'll even be able to avoid being dragged out, you know, with a 60 senator vote at one point. So this is the United States signaling its commitment to be the leader of the democracies that are opposing these authoritarian regimes. And that's important because if you stumble in one of these theaters in Taiwan, in Ukraine, in Israel, you stumble in all the theaters because the other authoritarians see that as a lack of will by the United States. And people need to understand that if we decide we're going to do something and protecting beleaguered democracies around the world is something we do, then you've got to stand up at every opportunity or at every confrontation and do something about it.
So, Admiral, have we done what we need to do, all told, all in, because the president's budget that came up was in real terms a cut given inflation? Does this remedy that?
So you can't remedy, you know, the direct investment in U.S. Procurement completely with this, because this doesn't, you know, this has several billion dollars worth of improving munitions. But I really appreciate that. In other words, there are billions of dollars worth of here that are just about our ability to produce, you know, as I said before, standard missiles, Patriots, Javelins, all those things. There's also $540 million to just help PACOM with very specific things it needed but didn't get in the fiscal year 24 budget. So, you know, those are good things. You know, and that has better joint training teams in Taiwan, more money for the defense of Guam, more money for undersea warfare experimentation. So there's little nuggets all over this bill. I'd also mention it goes goes after cartels that are trading in fentanyl. Another priority of the China Select Committee, who released, along with Representative Barr's testimony last week, kind of a jaw-dropping discussion of Chinese direct investment, you know, tax breaks for companies doing, you know, dealing fentanyl precursors to the United States. I mean, you can't make this up. It also repossesses $5 billion of Russian assets held in the United States for distribution to Ukraine. So it's all across the block. You know, it really did a lot. But does it make up for a defense budget that doesn't track with inflation? No. But does it really fill in some of the gaps to make sure that our allies and partners are ready to fight and that we can do better munitions in the future? Yes.
Admiral Mark Montgomery, thank you for getting up early for me this morning. I've read everything I could about this, and the specifics are just not there, and you provided a lot of them, and I appreciate it very much. Hope the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies puts out that kind of a summary as well. Follow the Admiral on X at Mark C. Montgomery. Follow the Foundation for Defense of Democracies at capital F, capital D, capital D, FDD. Thank you, Admiral. Great to talk to you this morning.
Thank you for having me, Hugh.
Always a pleasure. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. I'm joined now by Congressman Don Bacon of the great state of Nebraska. Good morning, Congressman. Good to have you.
Good morning. It's an honor to be on with you. I love reading your stuff, and I love what you stand for.
Okay, well, let me begin with an easy question then. When is Nebraska going to reinstitute college football? I'm just wondering if they're ever going to come back and have a football program there.
Well, we would like to have had that done like 5 years ago. We have a great coach. I think he's really brought us some great talent this year. So hopefully we'll keep making great progress year by year. But I think our coach is going to turn things around. But we're doing great in volleyball, baseball, and basketball right now. We just got to get it done in football.
I just like to always get my Nebraska friends and gig them a bit. Now, Congressman, you are a general. You are actually General Don Bacon, Air Force General, retired. And I want to talk to you about the Quality of Life Act. And I want to give you the background. I'm a civilian. I don't speak much military, but my wife's Marine Corps brat. I've got a son, a son-in-law, and a nephew on active duty. They're all officers, so they don't really have to live as an E-1 does. But what shocked my wife more than anything is when she visited our daughter. They were stationed in Japan. And they had food stamp aisles in the base in Japan because our enlisted men and women can't afford food. What in the world is going on?
Well, it's terrible, Hugh. It's disgraceful. So a year and a half ago, I went to Mike Rogers. He was the ranking member at the time, now our chairman. And I laid out this problem. About 1 in 8 of our enlisted people are on SNAP, or they're having to go to food banks. And that, for the strongest military in the world, that's disgraceful. And so he made it his priority this year to fix. But while we're digging into it, we learned that it wasn't just pay that's an issue. We were subtracting 5% from their housing allowance. The spouses were the largest demographic for being unemployed. The military, all the services cut the money going to barracks and the dormitories. So the GAO gave them a failing grade this past year. So as we looked around, we were failing in the quality of life for our servicemen and women, those who are defending our country, the greatest country in the world. And we know that we had to do better. So we put together a temporary subcommittee, an ad hoc subcommittee. It was going to last about a year. And our whole goal was to say, what do we need to do to fix quality of life? We have an all-volunteer military. It served us well. But if we don't fix this, our all-volunteer military is going to fail. So we put together 35 recommendations. I'm very proud of the work that we did, a very bipartisan report, and we're going to execute it this year.
Well, tell me, I got to ask you one specific. The BHA, Basic Housing Allowance, is nuts. It doesn't even begin to cover what these kids have. And I say kids, they're 18 to 22-year-olds. They can't live in California near Camp Pendleton on this amount of money. They can't live near Washington, D.C. on this amount of money. Did you guys address the BHA for enlisted people?
Yeah, we did in multiple ways. You're right. 40% of the people that get housing allowance to live off base are being underpaid, particularly like Washington, D.C., San Diego, the high-cost areas. What the military was doing was they were looking at the entire city and trying to figure out what would be the average housing needed. However, most of our military members want to have their kids go to better schools, so they were more selective. So they were living in areas that were significantly more expensive what the housing allowance was allowing, because they wanted safety. They wanted a good education for their kids. And this contributed to many of them going on SNAP or having to go to food banks. And so we made some changes to the housing allowance. We made it more transparent. We have we were subtracting 5% from everybody's housing allowance. We were using that 5% to go to weapons. that's not right either. We were buying weapons on the backs of our enlisted men and women. So we restored 100% of everyone's housing allowance in these recommendations. So we did address this issue, and it's a good point.
Now, I have continually made the argument to young people that the best decision they can make coming out of high school is to do a tour in the military for a lot of reasons. J.D. Vance will also explain them all in his book, Hillbilly-ology. The military teaches a lot of kids a lot of things, but they can't go in if their entering salary is, what is it, $24,000? I don't know how anyone lives on that, Congressman. So what do you want to raise it to?
Well, we're going to do a 15% pay raise for E1 through E4. And that gets all of these young folks above the SNAP threshold. And then we're going to restore 5% of their housing allowance. And we're going to relook at how we do the basic subsistence for food. And we're going to relook how we compute the housing allowance as well. You put all this together, it should have a significant impact on all of our junior enlisted people. And then we're going to address the dormitories, the barracks. We want to help out our spouses be able to get employment easier, working with the chambers of commerce. We also have problems with our medical care. People are waiting 2 months to get like specialized care, and that's not right either. So we have a lot of different things we're digging into.
And when does this bill get introduced, Congressman? I want to talk to you after the break about what we passed over the weekend, but when does the bill that you're working on actually get a vote or get processed?
We're going to put all of this in the National Defense Authorization Act. So we're going to put it in into a bill format in June or July timeframe. Then we'll vote on it in the House around September or October. And then we got to work with the Senate to get matching language. So it'll be done this year.
All right. Stand by, Congressman. I want to come back and talk to you about what Speaker Johnson moved through. I'm a big proponent of what happened. I want to know what you thought. I'm back now with Congressman Don Bacon. He's a member of the House Armed Services Committee. Congressman, over the weekend, the House National Security Supplemental passed. First of all, there were four pieces of it. How did you vote on each of those pieces?
I was a yes on all four. I think it's in our national security interest to defend Ukraine and have an independent Ukraine. Israel's our closest ally in the Middle East, and we need to deter China with Taiwan. And so I'm one of the folks who worked behind the scenes for months to make this possible. And I'm very grateful to Speaker Johnson for having the courage to get it done.
So what happens now in the caucus? Because if the knucklehead caucus comes together and throws out Mike Johnson, I really despair of holding the House in the fall.
Yeah, they're in a dysfunction and anarchy, no doubt. They're a minority, a group that want to see Speaker Johnson go, just like with Kevin McCarthy. I believe there's maybe between 3 to 5 they're this way. I'm not sure what the total number is, but we only have a majority of 2. I suspect because the Democrats don't want to see, many of the Democrats don't want to see this dysfunction either, that they'll be able to table the motion to vacate the chair. So in other words, all we need is about 5 to 10 Democrats not to vote, and this thing will go away. But we'll see how it progresses. It would be terrible for the institution, terrible for the Republican Party, for these knuckleheads, as you call them, to try to vacate the chair and kick out Speaker Johnson.
Now, Congressman, you're a general, so you've been around some serious people for a long time. Do you ever try and talk sense to these folks? Are they just stupid?
Well, 95% of us are together on this. We, you know, it was 215, roughly, or 214 of the 222 supported Kevin McCarthy. 8 of them voted with all the Democrats to remove him. Now we're looking at 3, 4, 5. I'm not sure what the number is. 3 that are officially wanting to remove Speaker Johnson. You know, this is more about cable TV getting social media hits. It's about getting attention. It's not about being part of a team. Teams win. You know, Ronald Reagan talked about, you know, if your friend agrees with you 80% of the time, he is your friend, not your enemy. And these folks are in the 99% or 100%, some kind of a purity test that they have out there. And we could do so much more together as a team. What's interesting is they oppose Speaker Johnson majority frequently, which forces the speaker then to do suspension votes, we call it, which makes them more bipartisan, which really forces the speaker to work more with Democrats. So it has the actual opposite effect of what they want. And it's, I don't know why they can't see it. they're actually they're strengthening or giving more leverage to the Democrat Party by what they're doing and how they're doing it.
But what I get at is either they have a plan or they're dumb as a desk. If they have a plan, I don't know what it is, and maybe you can enlighten me on that. Or are they dumb as a desk? You tell me. I know you don't want to use any names specifically, but none of these people are going to win the spelling bee. I just don't understand. Do they not know math?
No, they didn't have a plan in October, and we went 3 weeks trying to get a speaker. And they acknowledge they have nobody identified to replace Speaker Johnson. And so this is more about getting attention. They love the spotlight. They live in an echo chamber with a small segment of our party where they live. And it's not representative of the vast majority of the Republican Party, let alone America. So, yeah, they do not have a plan.
All right. So, Congressman, I want to wrap up here. I've got a piece in the edit process at The Washington Post. And I don't want to tip too much, but it's about who former President Trump ought to pick as his vice president. How many people do you think, what percentage of people would care if it's a veteran or not? One of the considerations I'm mulling over is we haven't had a veteran a long time in the White House or as vice president. And I'm just curious whether or not you think there are enough people who would care about that, that it would shift even a handful of votes in some states.
You know, the favorability of the military, though it's gone down somewhat over the last 5 years, is still the most respected institution in America. I think veterans, you know, we try to do what's right for our country. We try to look beyond the partisan politics by and large. I think it would be helpful. You know, Mike Pence made a huge difference on the ticket in 2016. A lot of the traditional Republicans were wavering, and when Mike Pence came on, they all came on board President Trump. I think it's so important that he get a great vice president to consolidate the party, because we cannot afford 4 more years of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. I mean, it's been terrible on the economy, terrible for our national security, and I just go on and on. So it's very important to get the right vice president. I think a veteran would be very helpful.
Okay, last question. Nebraska has the funny system that Maine has where you vote by congressional district. And I saw that a bill was moving through the Cornhusker state that would change that. Did that die or is that still alive?
It's still alive. It's one vote shy. We have 49 state senators. It takes 33 to pass this. They're at 32. So they could call back a special session if we get one more vote on that. And you know, what it does is, we have 48 states go winner take all. Nebraska is a 60-40 Republican state. So the district I'm in is 50-50, and it gives the Democrats the chance to get one more electoral college vote. And it would be one thing if Illinois or New York or California did what we did, but they don't. And so if every state did what we did, it would make sense. It doesn't make sense when you're just one of two out of 50.
Are you optimistic about flipping one more vote?
I would give it about 50-50. I've talked to some of the folks on the fence. I think it's possible. I don't know that it's likely. But I think the governor is very involved in this, and governors can be influential when they get one-on-one and talk to those who are wavering. So it's not done yet, but we don't have it in the bank.
I've studied the math. That one vote could be everything come the fall. Congressman Don Bacon, thank you for joining me. Thank you for your votes this weekend. And thank you for taking care of our enlisted men and women, because, boy, nobody thinks about them. And without them, we do not have a military. And I appreciate your putting them front and center. And good luck on this bill. Want to remind everyone, a great sponsor of the program is MyPhDWeightLoss.com. Generalissimo went on that program more than a year ago, lost 50 pounds. He's kept it off. And stress eating is not allowed, I don't believe, even though we're under a lot of...
Sure tempted to this week, aren't we?
Everybody is. But we don't... I'm sure they give you tricks of the trade to combat that, because that's one of the habits. You broke that habit. You're not going by Del Taco or Taco Bell.
Have not. No.
You haven't relapsed.
Have not relapsed.
And that is... And it's healthy, it's wise, it's productive.
864-644-1900.
That's...
844-644-1900.
Folks, so many people I know are disheartened that our country seems to have forgotten the importance of citizenship. and they wonder how a strong sense of citizenship might be revived. That's why my friends at Hillsdale College have produced a free online course on the topic, American Citizenship and Its Decline. Taught by historian Victor Davis Hanson, the course traces the history of citizenship and explains how it is undermined in America today by open borders, by identity politics, by the administrative state, and by globalization. Americans taking the course will gain a deeper insight about the connection between citizenship and freedom, an insight they can share with family members, friends, and neighbors. Hillsdale's free online courses are an important component of Hillsdale's mission to reach and teach increasing millions of people on behalf of liberty and the American way of life. So sign up today for Hillsdale's free online course, American Citizenship and Its Decline, by visiting hughforhillsdale.com. That's HUGHFORHillsdale.com. HughForHillsdale.com. Start your free course today at HughForHillsdale.com.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-702-5400. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-702-5400. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-702-5400.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
If Jesus came from Mississippi, if tears began to rise.
Welcome back, America. That's the music, the soundtrack to the podcast Look Through the Chaos. It's a great podcast, even though John Campbell's wrong often and Dwayne is always annoying. But Congressman, good morning, John Campbell. Welcome. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fine. I'm here in the Flint Hills of Kansas where life is beautiful.
Okay. I want to ask you something going way back to your congressional days. There is an Office of Civil Rights at the Department of Education. Now, we have four alma maters between us. I'm Harvard and Michigan. You're USC and UCLA. All four of those have had anti-Semitic and anti-free speech violations. Is it the job of the Office of Civil Rights to shut those campuses down or to punish them in any way?
Oh, wow. You know, I'm not a fan of the Department of Education generally. I have been in favor of abolishing the entire thing since I was in Congress. I mean, 20 years ago, I was wanting to abolish the Department of Education. Which, just to clarify, there are no federal, well, the only federal schools that exist are on military bases and they're run
Correct.
By the Department of Defense. The Department of Education has no schools and it has no teachers. I suppose there are former teachers who work at the Department of Education, but they're not there to be teachers. So I'm not a fan of that. I don't think I would necessarily support that. And that is not because I don't think what's happening on these campuses is completely abhorrent. It is completely and totally abhorrent. And I think the public, by not contributing to these universities, not sending your kids to these universities, not having anything to do with these universities, is the way to respond. But if the federal government steps in now, can't they step into Hillsdale someday? This is a Biden Department of Education. Could they not step into Hillsdale and say,
well, they can't go to Hillsdale because Hillsdale doesn't take any federal money. Hillsdale doesn't take a dollar of federal money. So they cannot be enforced upon by the DOE. But let me put it this way. If they're going to do anything, can't they stop a pogrom? I mean, Columbia is actually looking like a pogrom.
Yeah, you would think. But you know, Hugh, this whole thing, you and I grew up learning about Kristallnacht in 1938 and the Holocaust.
Absolutely.
And never again. And the generation underneath us and the generation underneath that, going through to millennials, grew up learning that. But it seems that now there's a new message going out to the Generation Z, I guess it is, or Y, or whatever it is, the generation under millennials, that is relearning, I guess, taking history and twisting it. And it's all a part of this objective that I speak about a lot, which is to completely tear down Judeo-Christian culture, tear down the Constitution, and replace America as a neo-Marxist state, because the anti-Semitism is something that, if you bring it back, will help tear society apart and help tear society down. And so it seems like they're letting it run because it achieves a greater objective.
Now, this is interesting. John, pause for a moment. I want people to understand. You cannot become more of a WASP than John Campbell. John Campbell's actually John Bayard Campbell III. He's like the WASP. I'm about as Irish Catholic as they can come. So we got no dog in this fight. We are not Jewish. We are about as far removed from Jewish as possible. But we are both. I'm disgusted, John. I'm just disgusted. How did this happen in America?
Yeah, it is. It is astounding, actually, how far we have moved on so many of these issues just in the last few years. I mean, none of this was going on in the 90s. None of this was even going on in the early 2000s. This is within the last, I want to say, almost 8 years or so, 10 years, something like that, that this kind of activity could come up and not be universally shunned, universally just repulsed by all of society, by the media, even by everybody. This was a standard that was broken. You don't just beat up people because they're Jewish. You don't keep them out of universities because they're Jewish. You just don't do this sort of thing. And it's been that way since 1945. And now it's coming back the other way. And it's thoroughly disgusting. And as I say, what it says to me is, as much as what it does to the Jewish community is terrible, it is beyond that. It is a rift in societal norms.
And I have a cousin once removed, brilliant 18-year-old. Her last name isn't Hewitt, so I can say this. She's going to Yale. And she's going to be a freshman at Yale in the fall. Now, that's a big deal. That's a good thing. But I really would rethink it. If they can't get their campus under control, I wouldn't let anyone near Columbia right now, because Columbia, unlike New Haven, you can take a subway from anywhere in New York and go up and punch the kids out of Columbia. That's not just Columbia students. But I don't think I would let my kid go to a school that is steeped in anti-Semitism. Would you?
Absolutely not. I had an interesting conversation with my younger son just last week, and he has two kids and one more in the oven. His oldest is about to go to kindergarten.
Is he the Harvard alum?
He is. Harvard.
Oh, he's the Harvard man.
Business School.
Yeah, the Harvard man.
Right, Harvard Business School. Harvard Business School. Anyway, he has his own business, et cetera, et cetera. But we were talking about this, and he said, that his older daughter would be in 12 years or something like that. Looking at him, what we discussed is looking at college or whatever it is we do with kids at that time. Essentially, he's basically saying that, again, the way you and I grew up was that, or the way we raised our kids was that after high school, if you wanted to, if this was of interest, if your family could afford it, et cetera, then you send a child to college because that's where they would learn more things and they would have a better education, a better life, and so forth. It's clear that's not the case right now, that's another norm that is breaking down, that is falling apart. And I think what he's saying, and I had to agree with him, is 12, 13 years from now, who knows how we'll look at this? I mean, will Yale and Columbia and USC, UCLA, Harvard, whatever, will they even still be around? If they continue in this path, frankly, I hope they're not.
There was a big brouhaha in the 90s about law schools would not allow the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marine Corps to interview students because of the don't ask, don't tell. and they threw them off. Then Congress passed a rider saying, if you don't let our military recruit, you're not getting any money. It seems to me that if these campuses do not make it safe for Jews, they ought not to get a dime. And Tom Cotton wants to tax their endowments, and I'm in favor of that, too. Because the ones with the big endowments have lost the most of their mind.
Yeah, I'm completely in favor of that. Tom Cotton wants to, and I think Senator from Missouri proposed that some years
ago. Josh Hawley.
Josh Hawley. And what he proposed, which I agree with, is he said if there was enough money in the endowments to basically make free tuition, which a lot of these colleges have, then the income from the endowment should be 100% taxed. And contributions to the endowment should not be tax deductible. And I agree with all that right now, regardless of whether they do this or not. They're just accumulating money tax-free that only benefits the professors and the administrators. If the tuition continues at these astronomical levels, when they have enough money to make it free, then they're not benefiting the students with this money. And that's not what they're trying to do. Not with their intent.
Your title of your podcast with Dwayne is Look Through the Chaos. There is chaos on campus. When you look through that chaos, what do you see on the other side?
What I see on the other side is there is a place for higher education, whether that is a liberal arts education like Hillsdale does that teaches you a broad understanding of Western civilization, which these leftist colleges don't like and so forth, or whether that is teaching electrical engineers and physicists and chemists and all of the applied sciences, which have and medicine, which have advanced society so greatly in the last few years. We need that. This society needs that, and we have to have those things. But when it is infused with leftist and neo-Marxist culture and indoctrination. And instead, we've seen in the applied sciences, where is it, at Duke and UCLA, where they are using DEI for doctors and saying that even if the doctor makes a mistake, we will overlook it if that doctor is of a certain ethnicity that we have decided we want to promote over other ethnicities. So they're even ruining the applied sciences, which we thought they wouldn't do. I think that these universities will either turn away from this, or they will die and they will be replaced by others. And we know whether it's Hillsdale or the University of Austin or other places that other universities and colleges.
Cedarville in Ohio. There are a lot of good schools. You know, my friends at Colorado Christian University, there are a lot of good schools, but you got to find them. Start with Hillsdale. John, I want to ask you one other question before we run out of time. In terms of the speaker, he did a very brave thing. I know you didn't agree with it, but he did a brave thing. Do you think he will be removed? Are the Republicans that stupid?
That's a very good question. I would have said no to that some time ago, but I don't know. And again, one of the things we've said in electoral politics for some time is who runs something or who's elected or who is speaker is not... You don't pick a utopian out of your mind. You pick people, actual people. So the question is, if they want to yank Speaker Johnson, who are they going to replace him with this time? And it took what? How long did it take? Was it a week?
Weeks.
Or 10 days?
Weeks and weeks.
Weeks. Before they were able to get Speaker Johnson in there. So if they yank him, who are they going to replace him with? And you would think they would sort that through before they pulled him out. And particularly the closer you get to the election, the closer the Republican conference is in chaos. As we get close to the election, the more likely it is that the next speaker is Speaker Hakeem Jeffries. And do these people really want to facilitate Speaker Hakeem Jeffries or
well,
not.
I will be listening now, to the next edition of Look Through the Chaos, because I have two things I require of that next edition. What is college going to look like after the chaos? And what is the House Republican caucus going to look like after the chaos? Because you promised to look through the chaos on the podcast. So you need to deliver.
We did. And we will.
I'm not sure you did. You were wrong about the budget. But we'll see. We'll talk about that another time. Congressman John Campbell, follow him on X at Look Through, THRU, Chaos. And Look Through the Chaos Pod is everywhere. Stay tuned, America.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.